Jewish Education and Media is pleased to present L'Chaim, a program that highlights the people, issues, and events of importance to the Jewish community. Now here is your host, Rabbi Mark Golub.
I'm Mark Golub, and there's a cliche about Jewish life, which, like all cliches, is often true. Whenever there's an incident in the news where someone did something bad, Jews look to see, was it a Jew? And partly because we feel every Jew is part of our family, Jews often feel personally embarrassed, even ashamed, when it turns out that the bum is a Jew. And of course, on the other hand, when anyone does something of merit, Jews quickly look to see if that laudable person is a Jew. And if it turns out the person is a Jew, there's an enormous sense of personal pride. Again, because this individual who's made a contribution to our world as part of our family is a Jew. And it doesn't matter how observant the individual might be or how strong their Jewish identity might be, even whether they're living as a Jew or not. Irving Berlin, Henry Kissinger, Sigmund Freud, they're Jews, and Jews are proud of them. And then, every now and then, a Jew makes an extraordinary contribution to our world and our society and is a profoundly committed Jew. And then our pride is boundless. On this edition of L'Chaim, I have the enormous honor to be sitting with a man who has had one of those unparalleled careers in which his work has moved humanity forward in its understanding of how our universe works and how human beings can more fully reach their divinely innate potential and be more caring and healing of others. It is my great privilege to introduce to you a Nobel laureate in the field of neuroscience, who's helped open windows into the human mind, especially with issues related to memory. Eric Kandel, the highly esteemed professor of biochemistry and biophysics at the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University, and the recipient of the 2000 Nobel Prize in Medicine for his work in physiology of memory. I'm sure many, many of you know who Eric Kandel is, but I want to tell you just a little bit more about what he has accomplished. Eric Kandel, who went to medical school, became a psychiatrist before turning his attention to the scientific study of the mind, is the author of the definitive textbook in his field, Principles of Neuroscience, a book used as a teaching reference text in medical schools and universities throughout the world. Eric Kandel is the founding director of the Center for Neurobiology and Behavior, now known as the Department of Neuroscience at Columbia University. And Eric has been a member of the United States National Academy of Sciences since 1974. Eric Kandel is the recipient of a boatload of awards and honors, including the National Medal of Science from President Lyndon Johnson, the Harvey Prize from Technion in Israel, an award for scientific breakthroughs, the Viktor Frankl Award of the City of Vienna, honoring outstanding achievements in the field of psychotherapy. Eric Kandel is the recipient of 22 honorary doctorates from American universities and universities around the world. And Eric Kandel's most recent book is entitled The Disordered Mind, What Unusual Brains Tell Us About Ourselves, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And on top of all that, despite all his awards and recognition, and even though he's lucky enough to be married to an extraordinary woman and renowned scientist in her own right, Denise Kandel, and they've been married for some 63 years as we tape this edition of L'Chaim, despite all his fame and celebrity, Eric Kandel is both a profoundly committed Jew and he is one of the loveliest and most gracious individuals one could ever meet. It is such a kick for me to have you at this table,
Mark,
Eric.
That introduction
Thank
alone.
You so very, very much, my
I
friend.
Wish my mother was here. She would believe it.
I... Your mother was quite a woman, by the way. Yes?
Yes.
Her name?
My mother?
Your mother's name?
Charlotte.
Charlotte. And your father?
Herman.
Herman.
He became Harris here.
Harris?
Yes.
They were married in 1923 in Vienna.
I thought 1924, but 23 well, is probably right. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And in essence, that's where your life began. Before we talk about the science, if we ever get to it, with all the things I want to talk to you about you, I want to start with how you become who you are. So I want you to take me back to Austria and tell me again, who were your parents? And you had a brother who, again, changed his name when he comes to America. It was Ludwig to begin with?
Changed it to Louis.
Louis. By the way, what was your given name?
Erich.
Erich.
E-R-I-C-H. Okay. I dropped off the H. That's
okay.
All.
So yours is almost identical.
Yeah.
In any case, there you are. It's the four of you, mother, father. You were the younger son. Eric, what was life like for you? Who were your parents, and what kind of Jewish home did you grow up in?
We had a nice Jewish home. My parents had a toy store on Kutschke Gasse, which in the main part of the street had a market, but the side buildings actually had stores in it. My father had a small but very nice store that still exists now.
It does?
Yes, absolutely, and we visit it every time we're in Vienna. We go visit them.
Where was he born?
My father was born in Olesko. My mother was born in Kolomea.
Ukraine.
Yes.
And he was from Poland, Russia type.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Were either of them from wealthy families?
No. My mother came from a very educated family. My grandfather, her father, was a very cultured Jew. My brother would say about him, he's the only man he knows who could speak seven languages and couldn't make himself understood in any one of them. Very scholarly Jew. He was so scholarly that he really didn't work. He expected his children to support him, which they by and large did. But a wonderful man.
And you, knew him, by the way.
Big influence on me. When I came to the United States... I came here in 1939. I went to PS 217. And when I looked around the class in PS 217...
You're in Brooklyn at this time.
I'm what?
In Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn. I saw these blonde, blue-eyed kids, and I thought, these are all non-Jewish kids. This is like Vienna. And so my grandfather, who sensed that I was uncomfortable, said, why don't I teach you some Hebrew? I know Braverman, who's the principal of the Yeshiva Flatbush. Maybe he'll accept you in a scholarship. So I was not interested in learning Hebrew, but I was dying to get out of PS 217. So he tutored me, and I got into the Yeshiva Flatbush.
What was that like, by the way, going to Yeshiva Flatbush?
Wonderful.
In the end of the 1930s, beginning of the 40s.
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful experience. Yeah.
Because?
I learned Hebrew.
Yes.
By the time I graduated, I could speak Hebrew quite well. I've forgotten a lot of it, but I could speak Hebrew quite well. I learned more about Judaism, got a very good English education, and I met nice people. I had good friends.
Before we go to come to Brooklyn, when you're growing up...
In Vienna.
To what extent are your parents actively Jewish, as opposed to what was for many families a strongly assimilated Jewish home?
No, my grandfather, who lived in Vienna, was an Orthodox Jew, and his influence was felt.
On your parents as well?
Yes. And my parents celebrated the holidays, and we went to synagogue on holidays.
You knew you were Jewish. Did you like it in Vienna?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
You write about Passover, by the way. It sounds like Passover was very lovely.
Lovely.
For you. Tell me, describe it a little bit.
I mean, the whole Mishpucha would get together, and, you know, in later years, I often would give a lecture at the beginning, something about the history of art or something general with pictures. So it always had sort of intellectualist pretensions, but it always had an interesting flavor to it. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like in Vienna, you had a large family or a large extended family. That's the feel I got from reading about you.
I'm not sure that it was very large. We had close ties with my mother's sister, my aunt, and her husband. We had less ties with my father's family.
And how did your mother and father feel about Austria and Vienna?
Well, I think that before Hitler came in, they liked it a great deal. My father liked Vienna an enormous amount. They went to the opera often. They weren't deeply cultured, but they enjoyed Vienna. I mean, you didn't have to be cultured in Vienna, go to the opera and things like that. I think if, you know, Hitler had not marched in, we would have stayed there.
Okay. How did you, as a 5, 6, 7, and 8-year-old child, for example, did you deal with anti-Semitism as a child?
I was not really aware of anti-Semitism as a child. I was aware that it was my brother's younger brother. He was so outstanding. Every time I entered a class, I said, "Ach, Ludwig Kandel's kind of Bruder." And I was sick and tired of hearing that because he really was exceptionally good. And that was a nuisance for me, having to always walk in his shadow.
But that's not anti-Semitism.
No. It had nothing to do with anti-Semitism. Right. I didn't really get over that until I got married. And
you always felt in some way second to your older brother?
Yes.
Until you got married?
Yes.
And then Denise is the one who changed it all for you?
Well, she pointed out to me he's terribly bright, but, you know, he's not as creative as you. I mean, you have all kinds of original. And this is probably true. He was a little bit more conventionalist thinking than I was. And I was lucky to accomplish a great deal.
Were you close to him as a brother?
Yes.
Were you close to your parents?
Very.
And you already said your grandfather had a very big influence.
Oh, yes. Very close to him.
Okay.
Yes.
Do you have memories of what it was like when Hitler comes in?
Absolutely.
Austria? Can you, you know, for most American Jews, this is ancient history, and we didn't live through it. Eric, what was it like that we didn't understand?
March 13th, Hitler marches into Vienna. And what happened was that Schuschnigg, the Chancellor of Austria, was being threatened by Hitler all the time. So he finally decided, why don't we have a plebiscite? Why don't we have to decide whether or not we should stay independent or join with Germany? And Hitler agreed. But as the date was coming closer, he realized he might lose the election. So he marched in. And boom, everything changed immediately. Mm-hmm. One of my classmates walked up to me and said, "Kandel, my father said I'm never to speak to you again."
Wow.
Yeah, wow. But this was typical. People turned against the Jews in a really dramatic fashion as a result of that.
The way you describe it, it feels like it was overnight.
Overnight.
But it was always there, Eric, wasn't it?
It must have been if it appeared so rapidly and so fully. But it was masked. I'm sure there was a lot of anti-Semitism in Vienna before Hitler came in. But the Jewish community in Vienna was an interesting one, a cultured one, and a fairly productive one. So there was no serious thought of leaving.
You write, and this is hard for me to, I'm sure it's true, but it's hard for me to believe. It's 1934, the Austrian Chancellor is Dollfuss, and he had outlawed the Nazi Party, although you write about the fact that he did many things to facilitate the entrance of Hitler, but he's assassinated, and you say, as a 5-year-old, that was the first time you became aware of what you call a political storm.
Yes.
5 years old, Eric?
Something like that.
Okay.
And I mean, in a vague sense.
Yes,
in a
very but sense. Something about this you sensed even as a child.
Yeah, well, everyone was just shocked by it. So, my friends, families, et cetera, it affected all of society.
Were you frightened?
Somewhat, yes. Yeah.
You also write that you were listening to this with a headset.
My brother
yes.
was very technically gifted.
Yes.
And he built the headset. We would listen.
As
you know, all of these things occurred, including when Hitler later marched in. We were listening to this.
How hard was it for your father and mother to leave? How was it hard? And you come with your brother.
Earlier.
Yes.
You would think I would be frightened to death.
Yes.
And you would think that my mother would be terrified. The amazing thing is, she took us to the train station because you can't take a ship from Vienna. We had to go to Antwerp. And so he took us to the train station. And here we were.
You and your brother.
I was 9. He was 14.
Yes.
Pishes.
Yes.
And my mother had such confidence that things would turn out that she didn't convey any sense of anxiety or concern to us. And I was not in any way worried, despite the fact that we were just punks and leaving to go to another country. And from there, we would take a ship that would take us to the United States. I mean, enormous changes in our life. But we handled it quite well.
Okay. You know, by the way, you're leaving your mommy and your daddy. I don't know that there are many children today who would not be just...
This was happening frequently. We almost left earlier. The British had made an arrangement whereby children could be brought from Vienna, probably other parts of Austria, to England, Jewish children, and to be saved. And I was scheduled to go. And I was about to go, and this was canceled. So this was, you know, going on all the time.
You knew this was going to happen to you?
Yes.
And you sort of got ready for it?
Yes.
Okay. Whom were you being sent to in America?
When I ultimately came to the United States.
Yes, somebody you were going
to. Yes, we had my uncle here, my uncle Berman, who was my mother's brother. And he was a very successful. He was in the insurance business. He had a mid-level position, but he was quite good at it. He liked it. He had a very nice house on Argyle Road in Brooklyn. And his wife, Paula, was the one that arranged for us to go to school, PS 217. My brother went to high school. But I went to elementary school, and they sort of took care of us when we first arrived, even though my grandparents were here.
Okay. Yeah. And your parents then do follow?
They followed, yes. Okay. 5 or 6 months later.
I am sure now you understand, either when I say now, it may have been when you were a young man, or but you now have a perspective. As you look back on it, do you think it was hard for your mother and father to leave Vienna? Because what you said was, had Hitler not come in, they might still be there. So they had affection.
Oh, my father loved Vienna.
Loved
Wien, it. Wien, nur du allein sollst mir die Stadt meiner Träume sein. Wonderful. It's a beautiful city, Vienna. And the Jewish community was content.
So do you have a warm feeling in your heart for Vienna?
I have mixed feelings. I now go there moderately often.
You know, there's a famous story that when you get the Nobel Prize, Austria wants to take credit for you.
Yeah. This I didn't let him do. But we have some friends there. I give talks there periodically.
But I'm asking you how you feel about it. Do you have an emotional attachment, or really? You're American, aren't you?
Yes, absolutely, without any question whatsoever.
And you say it as if you take pride in this country.
Are you kidding? This is the most fantastic country. What it's done for me and what it's done for so many people, it's just unbelievable. I came here with nothing, and I've had a marvelous career here, marvelous life here. This is a fantastic country.
When you look at what Jewish life is in America.
It's heaven.
It's heaven. Oh, Eric, tell us why it's heaven. Why is it heaven?
You know, I'm sure anti-Semitism exists to a significant degree in the United States, like it exists all over. I've never experienced it. Mm-hmm. I didn't experience it in Erasmus Hall High School. I didn't experience it at Harvard College. I didn't experience it in medical school at NYU. I didn't feel it in my residency at Harvard. It simply was not an issue. it absolutely is not an issue. In my lab right now, I don't even know every, you know, in some cases it's clear to me you're Jewish because we take off for the same holidays. But there's some people that then take off for the holidays. I wouldn't necessarily be aware whether they're Jewish or not. It's just not an issue.
When do you meet your wife?
Where did I meet
when?
When?
When and where? When and where?
Okay, when. So I met Denise, God, when was it? 1961 or something like that. Somebody gave me her telephone number, told me she's a very interesting woman, and that I should call her up. And I didn't. She didn't want to go out with me. I tried one thing after another. Nothing. It changed her mind until I all of a sudden dropped that I was from Vienna. And then the tone in her voice changed. I think she felt if he's European, he can't be all bad. She was born in Paris. So she agreed to go out with me, and I picked her up and asked her, where do you want to go? Do you want to go to a restaurant, or do you want to go to the best bar in town? And she said, I'd like you to go to the best bar in town. So I took her to my apartment, because Bob Goldberger, my roommate, was fantastically gifted, and he built an absolutely magnificent bar. And in those days, we drank scotch, and we had a spectacular collection. I haven't touched scotch for 40 years, but in those days, we had a spectacular collection of scotches. So I wasn't completely booked, but clearly. But she was comfortable, nothing, you know, unusual happened. And we became very good friends rapidly.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
You have children?
Yes, we have two children.
Where are they in life?
One is involved in business. He manages money. And the other one is a lawyer. She's interested in women's rights and women's issues.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful.
Wonderful.
Denise had... And I don't remember the details, but her family also was, in essence, a surviving family from the Holocaust.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. She left Paris after the war, and they were in hiding during the war, particularly her father, and they came to the United States. Yeah.
Okay. And it turns out that... You have a certain brilliance. She also has a certain brilliance.
Oh, she's fantastic. My wife is marvelous. Yes. She doesn't have the confidence in her intelligence that I pretend to have. but she's very strong.
Is she at Columbia with you?
Yes.
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah, wonderful.
That's wonderful. Okay. How would you describe now your Jewish connection and Jewish identity?
Very strong. I go to synagogue.
Where?
On high holidays.
Uh-huh.
I enjoy being a Jew. Mm-hmm. And we celebrate, you know, the high holidays and also Passover and things like that. I mean, I'm not a religious Jew, but I enjoy...
I'm talking about Jewish identity, not observance.
I have a strong Jewish identity.
Yes, okay.
I sing Jewish songs.
Oh, yes?
Sing one. Auf dem Pripetschek brennt der Feierle in der Stieb ist heiß. Such der Rebbe den Talmidim, du soll auf Beis. Such die Kinder lach, such die Teire, wo sie lehen du. Such die noch einmal, ein Tag noch einmal. Komm jetzt Aleph,
oh. Oh, Eric, you gave me chills.
You think I have a future in the Jewish theater? Yes. Second Avenue.
Yeah. Do your children have a Jewish identity?
Oh, very strong one.
You did very well, Eric, didn't you?
And what?
You did creating a lovely family. You and Denise.
Marvelous. The children are wonderful, and the grandchildren are wonderful.
How many grandchildren?
Four.
Four wonderful grandchildren?
Four wonderful grandchildren. And they have a strong religious identity.
I'm very proud of you. Yeah. All right, one last question on this before I turn to your work. I said to myself, I wonder where Eric is on the issue of God. Albert Einstein, supposed to have said that the more he learned about the universe, the more he felt there was, and I'll use now the word of the age, intelligent design behind it, and that more he thought that there, in some way, whatever it meant, there was a God. Have you in any way experienced something similar? Okay, so as far as you're concerned, this is a natural world, and if there's a, and whatever people mean by God, it is more poetry than real.
I think it's a construct. I think it has benefits, although it also has downsides, as we know. And I like being a Jew, even though I don't believe there's somebody up there watching me every minute.
I love it. Good for you. Okay. Can I turn now to your work?
If you want to.
I do. I first want, you know, you have an interesting professional journey because you start in the world of medicine. You go to NYU Medical School. What was, and by the way, as an undergraduate, you're studying history, correct?
History and literature.
Okay. So from a history major, history and literature major at Harvard, how do you end up at NYU Medical School?
So while I was at Harvard, majoring in history and literature, where I wrote my honors dissertation on the response to National Socialism of three German writers at different positions in the political spectrum, I fell in love with a woman, Anna Criss, whose parents were very famous New York psychoanalysts, Mariana and Ernst Criss. And they were very taken with me. He said, what do you plan to do? I said, I'm very much interested in intellectual history. I want to understand what happened in Vienna, you know, how people could be so civilized and all of a sudden, you know, turn against the Jews in such a horrible way. And he said, you're not going to learn this from intellectual history. This is, you know, you got to study the mind. You got to study psychoanalysis. So he got me interested in reading Freud, and I got very excited by it. And so even though I had never taken a science course before, I realized that in order to become a psychoanalyst, you really should go to medical school. And I quickly took all the requirements, and I was accepted at NYU Medical School without having completed the requirements, with the idea that over the summer I would take organic chemistry, the last course that I was missing. And I did that, and I went to NYU Medical School.
When you went to NYU Medical School, you already know you're going to be a psychiatrist.
I went there with the idea of becoming a psychoanalyst.
Psychoanalyst.
Yes.
And then you did ultimately become a psychoanalyst.
No, I trained so I could qualify to be one, but I didn't practice.
You never practiced.
No.
And why? What happens along the way?
I got interested in research.
Yes.
I started to work on the brain.
Yes.
And I liked that so much that I wanted to do it full time. And my wife really identified strongly with my research career. This is Denise. So when I finished my residency, I was a nobody. I was a pisher. And I was offered the chair of psychiatry at Beth Israel Hospital.
How does that happen?
Because I had so much scientific experience, and I continued with the support of the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry to do research during my residency.
What research were you doing at that time?
I was seeing how different class of cells in the brain behaved. I started off studying the hippocampus, which is involved in memory storage, and then I studied the neuroendocrine cells of the hypothalamus, and I showed that the properties of the cells don't vary that much. It's the pattern of interconnections that varies a great deal. Then I was able to show in very simple ways that learning involves changes in the strength of synaptic connections. So I was off to a very nice start. So I thought I would continue in this direction. And I was offered all kinds of opportunities because of the fact that most people in psychiatry in my days didn't do any research, mm-hmm. and I had this advantage to get all kinds of, you know, precocious opportunities. Mm-hmm. But my wife said, what, throw this away? This is really, you want an administrative job. It's an absolute waste of time. You don't want to be chairman of a department. So she encouraged me to continue doing research.
Where?
This was at Harvard.
Okay. Eric, how much do we understand about the brain?
How much do we understand about the brain? Very little, but much more than we did 20, 30 years ago.
Okay. What's very little mean, though?
Well, we know that there are two hemispheres. We know they have somewhat different functions. We know how different aspects of behavior are localized to different regions of the brain. We have a fairly good understanding. When you damage this region, you have this kind of a defect. You damage that region, you have a different kind of defect. So we have...
But you still said we know very little.
Well, the nature of consciousness and things like that, the higher order questions, we're just beginning to touch.
Are there aspects of how the brain works that you say to yourself, I wish either I or somebody in this field could crack that question?
Well, there are lots of questions in the brain that one can say this about. There's fascinating questions. And, you know, unlike neurology, which has more defined phenotypes, the things that concern psychiatry is a little bit less well-defined, and it's more difficult to localize and to analyze. But, you know, people are making good progress, so it's coming along.
As a side question, where do you think we are in being able to really treat and even conquer diseases like Alzheimer's or multiple sclerosis or ALS or Parkinson's?
These are all extremely difficult diseases, but we're making progress with all of them, slowly but surely.
Do we understand what causes them?
Yes. The cause is, in some cases, really quite well understood. But to cure it is something else. Mm-hmm. And that's going to take some time.
Okay. So as a layperson, I say to myself, if we have learned what causes it, in my mind, I say to myself, that's more than half the battle. But maybe I'm wrong.
No, it's more than half the battle, but that means still 40% of the battle has to be carried out.
Okay. Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
I'm quite optimistic. I'm optimistic because, number one, more people are going into psychiatry, more people are going into brain research. I mean, brain research has now become a very active topic, and many good people are going into it. And this is what a field needs in order to really... move along.
So, you've done a lot of work on memory. Eric, you know, there are many people who, as they get older, they can remember things that happened to them a long time ago, and they have a hard time remembering why they walked into
the room. They have a difficult time forming new memories and storing those.
What's going on there?
Well, there's a weakening of connections in the brain. And the ability to strengthen connections, which is the mechanism whereby learning occurs, is not as effective. So people, in order to remember something, when they mature, have to work hard at it, and they have to work to keep their brain alive. There is a hormone called osteocalcin, released by bone, which combats, to a modest degree, age-related memory loss. So I think it's important for people as they age to walk more. So the release...
To what more?
To walk more.
Interesting.
Absolutely. Because that causes osteocalcin to be released from bone, and osteocalcin reverses age-related memory loss.
Is this generally known?
It's just emerged in the last year or so.
Do you walk?
Yes.
Consciously? For this
consciously
purpose?
Consciously. Well, I walk more now than I did before, now that I know it. And yes, it's in part conscious.
How is your memory?
So-so.
You seem to have a wonderful memory.
I've got a reasonably good memory. It's not spectacular.
Okay. Yeah. But this is part of the aging process.
Yes.
It's just that's what life is.
Yes. Well, some people have more problem with it than others, but it is part of the aging process. But that doesn't mean one can't circumvent it. You can't counteract it. And walking is one way. Using the brain, learning a new language...
Helps the brain?
Absolutely.
Why is that?
You're exercising it. When you exercise the brain, you keep it alive, you strengthen connections. Very, very good for aging.
And that, you know, when you think about exercise, you're thinking of muscles.
Brain is the same thing.
How is the brain the same thing?
When you learn something, you're exercising the neurons of your brain.
Are you really?
Absolutely. They're called into activity.
And somehow by calling them into activity, they become stronger, more
active.
The
connections between them become stronger.
And learning a language can help. You know, but many people say, I'm too old to learn a language.
I'm sorry?
Many people say, when I was young, it was easier for me to learn a language, and now that I'm older, it's harder.
That's why you should learn it, because it's harder. Learning a foreign language is a very good way to keep one's brain young. Of course, it's going to be hard, but force yourself to learn a language, and you'll see you'll do very well.
Excellent, excellent. Eric, what's your perspective on the issue of nature and nurture? How much of what we are is who we are as opposed to how we were raised?
And how much of it is genetically determined?
Yes.
A significant amount. That doesn't mean that the raising is not a very important part of it. So these are two complementary processes, and the more you're endowed with, the less you need from the other, but it's nice to have both.
Absolutely. Are you comfortable with the way modern American culture approaches human nature and the mind and the way in which people become who they are and how to strengthen the personality of people? Are you comfortable, or are there things that make you uncomfortable about that?
I think America is a wonderful country, and God bless it. And I think at least the people that I know, I mean, it's a great country. It has enormous diversities of opinions and attitudes. But among my friends, almost everyone has a very reasonable attitude toward the mind, how they should raise their children, et cetera, et cetera.
And American culture, you feel as a whole, is
it's very healthy.
Very healthy. That is lovely. Eric, is intelligence inherited?
Sure.
It's part of DNA?
By definition, yes.
Okay. So what happens when people say that certain peoples, because of the DNA that is transmitted to their children, and this is said often about Jews, that the extent to which there is something called Jewish intelligence, the extent to which it's always cited, the number of Jewish Nobel laureates is far exceeds the percentage of Jews in the population.
20% of all Nobel laureates are Jewish. It's unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. It should be 0.2%.
Okay. So the question is, and in some way you know this becomes a politically incorrect question, but I'll ask it anyway. To what extent is Jewish intelligence part of this Jewish communal inherited gift? And does that mean, conversely, that there are peoples who simply, not because they're bad or anything they did or did not do, but they have a different, and you know, most Jews are not 6'6" and play in the NBA. And there's DNA and genetics there as well.
Of course.
Okay. But I'm asking you, if anybody says to you, explain to me the extent to which a people's, a family's DNA affects, and then you ask, what about this Jewish people and the Jewish family? What's your assessment of this?
I think it's both. I think there is a genetic predisposition, probably. But also, you have to remember that the Jews were literate very early on in their history, that they always have been people of the book. They've read, they studied the Talmud, they engage in intellectual activity. So they're priming their brain to be useful.
It's the exercise you talked about before.
Absolutely. So I think you have both components there. I think there is a little genetic predisposition that Jews, to a significant degree, may be able to do quite well intellectually. But in addition, they also work their brain a great deal.
It is appropriate for Jews to take pride in this, don't you think?
Absolutely.
So my understanding is much of your work and your study has been in this most interesting connection between mind and art and the psychology of individuals and the way in which artists function. Can you talk about, how did you get interested in that? And what's the most interesting thing you found?
First of all, I think you're overemphasizing it. I collect art, and I enjoy art a great deal. In the last, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, I've begun to write a little bit about this. So I am very much interested in sort of a Viennese school of art appreciation, which began with a guy called Alois Riegel, who said that it's very important to realize that there are two parts about a painting. One is painting it, and the other is the beholder's share, how a viewer responds to it. And he concerned himself with the issue of, you know, how does one perceive a work of art? And I think that's very interesting, and I've looked into that a little bit. So I think this is a very fascinating problem.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you say that we know a little bit about the mind, and then at the same time, what we do know is so wonderful. I'm asking the same kind of question of you. As you now reflect upon the work you've done over a career, are there things you've learned about the brain which you never expected to learn, and for you, Eric, personally, are sort of exciting?
Well, I was one of the early people to show that learning involves changes in the strength of synaptic connections. That was an idea that was entertained, but there were three or four rival ideas that got equal, if not more, attention. But I was able to use a very simple reflex, show that it could learn, and so I could use that, the simplicity of that reflex, to explore what happens. And I showed, we always knew that nerve cells talk to one another in an area called the synapse. I showed that these synapses are plastic. If an animal learns something and remembers it for a short period of time, the synapse is strengthened, but there's no anatomical change, just a functional change. If you do repeated training, so the memory persists for days, weeks, or the lifetime of the individual, you actually see an anatomical change in the brain.
In human beings?
In human beings, this has now been shown. Also, it was originally shown in experimental animals.
But it happens in animals as well?
Yes.
It
was discovered in animals, then shown to also apply
okay.
to humans.
I just want to make sure I understood. What you're saying is the phenomenon you've described, you begin by seeing it in animals. There can actually be a physiological change.
It is a physiological change. Yes.
And this is what happens in humans as well.
Right. So there's an area in the brain called the hippocampus, which is very important in memory storage. And if you, the best place is London. If you go to London cab drivers, who really have to know the city very well, you see the hippocampus gets larger in those people.
Literally?
The longer the drive. And when they stop driving, the hippocampus starts to shrink.
It's the exercise again.
And that's just amazing.
It's amazing.
Amazing.
And that was something people didn't know at one point.
No. No. Mm-hmm. The brain is very plastic.
And for the lay audience, by plastic you mean?
Malleable. The anatomical structure can change.
It can change. Does that mean that a person can get brighter?
Yes.
And Eric, do animals
absolutely
think?
Sure. They make strategic decisions.
Yeah. Not instinctive decisions.
Both.
But at one point...
They learn.
At one point, the general understanding was when you saw an animal do something, it was driven by instinct, not conscious, what we think of as conscious thought.
Animals have instinct, as we do, and that drives a lot of their behavior, but they also can learn things, and that learning process is similar to ours.
Very often you'll hear people say the difference between human beings and animals is when you use the word conscience, it's not like there is a conscience literally, but what they're meaning is people make moral decisions.
Well, that may be stronger in humans, more
stronger,
more developed.
Are you saying that it exists in some degree in animals as well?
I would think so, yeah.
So there could be a sweet cat and not a sweet cat?
Yes, yes, yes.
So the best thing that happened to you is you get a very bright animal with a high,
That's what people select.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yep, yep, yep. And animals vary in the degree to which they show affection. So if you want to get a dog, you take not only an intelligent dog, but somebody who's very affectionate.
And you feel that that has to do with, in some way, the mind of this animal?
The brain, yes.
It does. I wonder if it's also true genetically as well, whether lovely dogs breed lovely dogs.
Probably.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Amazing.
There's no end to this, is there, Eric?
Biology is wonderful. You're going to become a biologist when this is over.
You made a reference, and the reference was that when you were talking to somebody and you were at Harvard undergraduate, and you said to him, I'm interested in learning, how did the Austrian people suddenly turn? And the answer he gave to you was, if you think you're going to find this in history, you're wrong. And what you really want to study is psychology and the mind.
Ernst Chris said that to me. Yes.
Was he right?
Yes.
And no.
Yes, exactly.
And so as you look back on it, and I know, look, I don't know the extent to which you want to talk about this, but the extent to which you're comfortable talking about it. One of the things, there's two aspects of you that are so fascinating for anybody to sit and talk to you. One is your understanding of something which most lay people have such simplistic notions of. A, the brain, and B, associated with it, is how it works and how it affects personality.
Well, how can people know it? I work in the area.
Yes, exactly.
I'm a carpenter, right?
Yes. So being able to talk to you, whether you're here on L'Chaim, whether you're on PBS television, anybody, or whether you're speaking in some group, or whether you're speaking to a group of people in your own lab, people you're with have a differing degrees of sophistication about this, and they're fascinated to be able to talk to you because you've studied this your whole life. The other thing that's interesting about you is you came out of a world that, especially these days, with the rise of anti-Semitism in Western Europe. It's not just Eastern Europe. It's Western Europe that many people want to understand. How did it happen? And in retrospect, are there things we should have learned and didn't learn? And my understanding is that, and not everything I've understood about you is right. My understanding is you love teaching. Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm coming to you, and I'm asking you as a teacher, as you look back with the experience and the perspective you bring, and experience means this is your first 8-9 years, you grow up in this, your parents stay a little bit longer, they live this, you all end up in America, it's got to be part of who they were and how it shaped your parents and how it shaped you. It's like I have your living history with me. And so I'm asking you, I want you now to tell me, as you look back on the question that drove you as an undergrad in Harvard, how do you answer it for yourself now, as you look back at what happened to the people of Austria, and really the people of Germany, and Poland, and Hungary, and what does it say to you about human nature as a whole? So I'm asking you to talk about that for a moment.
That's a very complicated question that I've never really studied. But it strikes me, and there are a number of examples for it, that people enjoy selecting a subgroup of the population. And criticizing them, restricting their activities, punishing them in various ways, etc., etc. You see this in racial differences, African Americans, for example, with the Jews. You know, this has historically been going on for a long time, and it takes a population a long time to come to grips with it, to realize that this is a complete bias that is detrimental to the country, it's detrimental to the people who have the hate, not just the people who have the experiences who are having the hate exercised on them. It's a very complicated thing. It must be satisfying to be able to hate somebody.
That's an interesting comment. Very interesting comment. Again, people can read about it if they want. Give me as brief a synopsis as you want. What drove you to say to the Austrian government when they said, oh, look, Erich Kandel, the Austrian, won the Nobel Prize? You didn't have to say anything, but you did.
Oh, that's bullshit.
In what sense?
I said, this is absolutely nonsense. This is not an Austrian Nobel Prize.
This offended you?
Yes, deeply.
And you were going to speak out about it?
I did.
Yes, you did. And somehow, they tried to make it better.
They responded appropriately. They backed off.
You told them to change the name of a street.
Yes.
And they did.
Yes.
What else did they do?
They put a plaque in the building to my parents, and I lived in it and asked them that.
It's more than that.
They haven't changed their life that much. I mean,
Have you forgiven them?
No.
But you go.
But that doesn't mean I forgive them. I go them in order to show that they really should beg for forgiveness from the Jews. And, you know, I have ties there. I have my father's old store, the building we lived in.
It's a courageous stand on your part, Eric. Did it cost you anything in the scientific community here in America?
That I went to Austria?
Yes.
No.
Or that you took any of the stands you've taken?
Well, I don't know about that. I'm sure I've offended some people with some of the positions I've taken. But I don't take that strong public political stances.
Okay. I want to end with some fun. All right?
Sure.
So when you were either as an undergrad or in high school, I don't remember, you were an athlete.
Yes, I was captain of the Erasmus All-Track Team.
You were a captain of the track team.
One thing you learn as a Jew in Vienna is how to run.
Were you a Brooklyn Dodger fan?
Yankees.
You were, even though you lived in Brooklyn, you were a Yankees fan.
And my son is a Yankee fan.
And your son is. So you're still a Yankee fan.
I don't pay attention. I have not paid attention to baseball since I've been in college. But my son is really addicted, and he has season subscription. And I've agreed to go with him every once in a while. Every couple of years, I go with him to a baseball game.
You were a sports editor.
Yes, for the Dutchman.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes. I wrote also for Gotham Sports, a commercial thing. I wrote Breaking the Tape with Erich Kandel.
Okay. So you've written a series of very scholarly books in your field. And the notion people might have of you is that you're serious every moment of your life.
No.
No, right?
Not at all.
You're just a person.
I enjoy writing. This is pleasurable for me. You know, some people watch television in the evening. I sit down and write. Mm-hmm.
And what do you and Denise do for fun?
We go to museums. We love that. We both love to swim. We walk. Go to theater. We don't go to the movies very much, but we go to theater. And we go to the opera. We love the opera.
So you're having a good time.
We have a wonderful marriage, and we have a very good time.
I'm very happy for you.
Yeah.
Eric, as you, I asked you before a question about your view of Jewish life. So I just want to ask you, again, you've had a unique experience in your whole life, not simply because you have had a brilliant career and all of the achievements and accomplishments, but you also have a strong Jewish identity that comes
very strong.
That comes from your parents back in Vienna. And at the moment, American Jewry is struggling with Jewish identity. So I don't need you to talk to me. I want you to talk to them. What is it that you, what's the advice? Not as, you know, Eric, not as Dr. Erich Kandel, but as Erich, what's your advice now for American Jewry as we approach the Jewish future in the 21st century?
Um, I like being a Jew. I like the values of Judaism. I don't go to synagogue often, but when I go, I enjoy the chanting, and I chant along. And I think the Jewish religion is a wonderful religion with high, you know, reasonably high moral standards, a wonderful scholarly tradition. And, you know, I don't go to synagogue that often, but usually when I go, I enjoy myself.
It has nothing to do with synagogue. It's how deeply, profoundly the Jewish core is inside you. And Jews express it in various ways. And it is clear to me how much this Jewish thing, Jewish identity, and your Jewish past means to you, and your parents, and your grandfather.
Absolutely.
And everything that shaped you.
Yes.
And then, lo and behold, you're able to make this marvelous contribution to the world as a whole. It's been an honor.
Oh, it's
to sit with you. You are lovely. And I wish you kol tuv v'hatzlacha, only goodness for you and Denise and your children and your grandchildren. Thank you so much, my friend. Dr. Eric Kandel, professor of biochemistry and biophysics at the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University. But what's really here? He is the recipient of the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his groundbreaking work on the physiology of memory. He's a world leader in a most complicated and critically important field of scientific study, and he is a wonderfully committed Jew, and again, a very special, lovely human being. Even if you've seen him dozens of times before, I hope you have enjoyed meeting him here on L'Chaim and JBS. Of course, I'd love to hear any thoughts or comments you may have to my conversation with Eric Kandel. Please email me, write me, post on our Facebook page, or tweet me. I would love to hear from you. And remember, if you are a podcast fan, you can now listen to the L'Chaim podcast, available on iTunes and Google Play, wherever you listen to your podcasts. And so until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. L'Chaim, my friends, to life.
Jewish Education in Media.
We would be pleased to send a complimentary DVD of this program to anyone who wishes to support JBS with a tax-deductible gift of $36, double chai or more. Simply visit the JBS website at jbstv.org and click on the Donate button to make a donation by PayPal or your credit card. And please, indicate the program for which you would like a DVD. Or you can send your tax-deductible check to JBS, P.O. Box 180, Riverdale Station, Bronx, New York, 10471. And again, please remember to indicate which program you would like to receive with our compliments. And we thank you for your kind support.